From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. We've had a lot of great conversations on the show this week, so let's get started.
And let's open with a question, Megan. When is the earliest possible time that New York State could operate, I mean feasibly actually do it, could operate with totally clean energy?
Well, I know the answer, so.
I know, it's not like, I know, I'm really setting you up there. But one thing we often hear in politics is, you know, do it by 2040, or you often hear 2050. But Mark Dunley from the Green Education and Legal Fund says, he recalls, for example, speaking to a scientist and a professor about this question. And it turns out, if we really want to, technologically, can we do this sooner? Yes, we can get off fossil fuels a lot sooner. Let's listen.
Which is it? Is it 100% by 2030 or is it 100% by 2050? Because you have two different numbers out there. And he said, well, it is technologically feasible to do it 100% by 2030. And why we say 2050 is because we felt we needed to add 20 years in to give the politicians and the economy to deal with it. And I said, Professor, you know, I've been doing this for 45 years since I helped start NYPIRG. If you give politicians 20 years, they're going to add on another 20 years and take 40 years. You don't need to give the politicians extra time. They will take it anyway. And so we need to push it as fast as possible. And, you know, Bernie Sanders and Bill McKibben, you know, who was head of 350, you know, they lobbied and got in the Democratic National Party platform this year that we need a World War II type mobilization like climate change. Like we did after Pearl Harbor, we have to put everything on the table and redesign the economy. I don't think we're anywhere close to a World War II type of mobilization. And the climate scientists say that the commitments that were made in Paris at the COP21 agreement lock us into catastrophic climate change. Even though they lower the goal from 2 degrees centigrade to 1.5 degrees centigrade, reality is what they put on the table in Paris is probably closer to 3.5 degrees increase. And then, of course, you mentioned Donald Trump now being president. He wants to walk away even from that commitment.
So not nearly enough, even with what was, quote unquote, accomplished in Paris.
Correct.
And when it comes to the way you get there by 2030, we're talking about a huge redesign. You said of the economy. The economy, yes, our energy grid, to get it done. And what you're saying is the experts have told you, if we committed to it, it could actually happen.
Right.
What's the biggest lift to do it, though?
Well, it's politics. But think about iPhones. Probably most of the listeners have iPhones. 10 years ago, did people have iPhones? Go look at a picture of New York City in the early 1900s. And one year, you have a picture, and basically, the transportation is all horses in New York City. And 5 years later, there's no horses on the street. It's all cars. We have done technological transitions previously in a very, very short period of time. The technology exists. There are heat pumps out there. There is solar. There is offshore wind. There's no offshore wind in New York, in the United States. We just started a small project on Block Island, Rhode Island. There's a lot in Europe. The technology exists. We need to import it.
Mark, my concern is, you know, whether it's Bernie Sanders or McKibben or whoever says, look, after World War II, they mobilized. There was an effort to do something. It was almost a national priority. You're responding, but you're responding to a direct, easily digested event. You could point to Pearl Harbor. Everyone is outraged. They could see it. There is pain. They want to respond to it. Mobilizing is something that's doable. My concern is, how do you mobilize, whether it's in New York State or nationally, when you don't have a Pearl Harbor-like event to point to?
We have WXSI do climate change every single day on this show.
Well, we do a lot of it.
Right.
But I'm not sure it's moved a lot of people.
But I think actually the public does agree. But the problem is, if you ask people, is climate change real and should the government do something about it, overwhelmingly the answer right now is yes. But then you ask them, rank the issues, you know, 20 issues, what's the most important? Climate change still comes down as number 18. You know, so they agree it's a problem, but it's not a priority. And I feel, unfortunately, I was in New York City during Hurricane Sandy. New York City struggled to get back on its feet. There will come a point where a city is hit by one of these massive hurricanes and it will not get back on its feet. And will that be enough to convince people, boy, this is really serious? But I think as more and more people actually experience extreme weather, whether that's flood or droughts or hurricanes, that will wake, you know, people up.
Next, a sensitive subject on college campuses. Trigger Warnings and Free Speech. We sat down with Alan Charles Kors, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and also the co-founder of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Kors was in Rochester because RIT hosted a symposium on the subject of free speech on campus.
Now, our guests largely agreed that college campuses are moving in a dangerous direction, with many students, speaking generally, not trying to overdo it here, but students in many places trying to shut out voices that they don't like. In this clip, our guests discuss both free speech and trigger warnings. We're going to start with Professor Kors, and you will hear Richard Feldman, a professor and dean at the University of Rochester.
To infantilize people, to use Joe's term, to say to anyone, we understand that you are what? Too weak to live with freedom? No one who tells anyone that they are too weak to live with equal protection of the law, too weak to live with the First Amendment and freedom of speech, no one who tells you that you are too weak to live with freedom is your friend. That is what we should be teaching students.
Dean Feldman, do you empathize at all or sympathize with what Alice is saying when you think about sexual assault victims, when you think about students of color who might have felt discrimination, you know, or do you agree with what Alan is saying here?
So I certainly agree with the caller that there are students on campus who have grown up in very challenging circumstances, have arrived on campus having experienced trauma.
Alan says not very many.
A decent number, though. How, if at all, that connects to the attitudes towards speech and freedom of speech is another matter. And I don't know that I could draw a really clear connection there. So I'd be careful about that. But I do think for some number of our students, I know a non-trivial number here at the U of R, There's truth like that, and there's factors that we should be attentive to. If I could very quickly just describe one anecdote, this is a little bit off our exact topic, but it might help us understand something. Some years ago, I think it was around the time that it was the Charles Murray book, so 20, 25 years ago, I used an example in class out of the blue. It wasn't the topic of the class, but I used an example about race and IQ to illustrate a point about reasoning and something about statistics. And I hadn't talked, the two students weren't prepared for that topic. I just raised it. And after class, two black students came up to me and perfect asked that. They just said, I wish I had known that you were going to be talking about that, because discussing that topic in class, I felt exposed. I felt that you know, my intelligence was being questioned. And we don't object to your using the example, but we object to your to the way it just sort of came up out of the blue and we were unprepared. And so they were talking about what's now called a trigger warning, but we didn't have the vocabulary then. And I thought they made a good point. I thought that was fair. That was a disturbing thing to them. And I think a thing we don't realize about some of our students is the number of things that affect them pretty deeply that to many of us just seem like no big deal, but to them really make a difference. And we do well to be aware of that.
So is there a middle ground where you say, look, it might not have been called a trigger warning then, but you thought it was a reasonable request because they weren't saying, you can't talk about that.
No, not at all.
There's a difference, though, by saying, you can't teach that, you can't talk about it.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. It's just let us know so we're prepared. Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's fair.
I think that's an extremely important distinction. I'd go further that any movement toward trigger warnings will be the end of education. I mean, trigger warnings about what? Your religious beliefs might get questioned. Your belief in an afterlife might get questioned.
Let's say you're a sexual assault survivor.
And
there's a film or a book. Should you get warned that the material may be difficult for you?
No, you've chosen to go to a university and you're going to be exposed. And the awful thing that happened to you is what happened. That's the trauma. That's the awful thing. Reading about rape is not the trauma of rape. However, it seems to me that apart from coercive trigger warnings imposed on faculty, there is what's just been explained, an understanding on the part of professors, a reasonableness, a sense of, I don't want to shock my students. I don't want to offend unnecessarily any student in this class. And I certainly don't want, it's not my goal, to make people feel personally uncomfortable. So common sense, decency, compassion.
But not trigger warnings.
But not trigger warnings.
Okay.
Or they'd be endless.
Now we'll turn to a subject that always gets a surprising amount of listener feedback, the traditional trades. And in this case, it's the personal story of a woman who had been laid off from her career as an architect. She took a class to learn how to refurbish old windows in her historic house, and then she built that knowledge into a business called Building Hugger. She employs a dozen people now, and last year they restored more than 1,000 windows in the Detroit area.
Her name is Amy Swift, and here she is telling the story of her first job and how quickly she learned that she could build a career out of it.
It was a friend of mine who had purchased a house and couldn't find anyone to just put glass in his steel casement windows that he had taken the AC units out of. It took him 3 months. Someone had come by and gave him a quote for $17,000 for exterior storm windows, which was not what he wanted. He just wanted glass in his windows. And so he called me desperate and said, "Will you please just put this glass in this in my windows? Like, fall is coming." And then, you know, I took a selfie hanging out the window and posted it on my on my Building Hugger page. And I haven't stopped getting calls since. It's just been, I hired my first, that was September of 2014. And I hired my first person in January 2015. And we've been going strong ever since. I think back in, you know, when I was in school, when I was in high school, I wanted to take woodshop. And I was told that's for boys, but it was for boys that like didn't do well in school. Like it was for the stupid kids, which you have two pathways ultimately that you're generally given as a young person. And one is to go to college and one is to learn a skill. And there's a stigma that is a very strong cultural stigma that we assign to trades work. And I think that it pushes people away from what they may have been an interest innately. I have an incredible student loan burden. I think that maybe I could have done well for not having, you know, gone through all of that training to be an architect if I, you know, had really focused in and said, no, I know I'm a girl and I know I'm a smart girl, but I think that there's a role for me here in the trades. But I think it comes with encouraging people or young people to follow what is ultimately a passion. I think that destigmatizing the trades is really critical to that. I know Mike Rowe talks about that and advocates for the destigmatization of the trades. And I mean, the work that we do, it's an incredibly challenging field intellectually. I mean,
no doubt about it.
It's
no
like doubt. Giant puzzles that we have to put back together, you know. And so, but it is also like a very skilled trade that you hone over time. And a lot of this knowledge is at risk of being lost because we have, you know, some old timers that are retired or retiring very soon. And there hasn't been robust apprenticeship programs that have filled that middle part. So you have some old timers and then you have younger people that are starting to think about entering the trades. And so it is the time to act is now.
Finally, let's listen to some wisdom from a woman named Yvonne Hilton. 10 years ago, at the age of 44, she was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. This weekend, she's emceeing the National Parkinson's Foundation's annual Rochester Symposium.
Her story sheds light on how varied Parkinson's disease is and how far we've come in dealing with it.
Every person, you know, the transition, the timeline of the disease, how you progress over time, how quickly it progresses, different symptoms. Some people lose their sense of smell almost immediately at a very young age before physical symptoms begin. Some people have just terribly oppressive anxiety or depression. Other people have a tremor. And I'm grateful to say I haven't experienced any of those things. Maybe a mild tremor would be noted by the doctors, but you know, the depression that some of my friends deal with, I'm just so grateful that that's not something that's layered on top of the disease. And as I said, is that people, you know, move forward in their own diagnosis, their motor symptoms are all different as well. Some people have stiffness in their neck, or they have dystonia where their hands or feet kind of curl up and they're unable to loosen their grips. It's fascinating.
And if I can ask then, Jevon, this is where my ignorance shows. I would have thought, you know, you go back 10 years ago to your diagnosis, and from the stories that I've heard shared with me personally, Parkinson's, people living with Parkinson's, often it is, you know, an early tremor or some kind of a symptom that would lead one to want to get an understanding. But for you, what was it that led to that?
Believe it or not, I had to concentrate on lifting my feet off the floor. I'd be standing at the sink doing dishes, and I had to physically get my brain to connect with my feet to move them, and I thought, that's weird. And then in the shower, washing my hair, I would try to step back to rinse my hair, and I would have to, like, connect my brain with my feet again. So that coupled with this just incredibly overwhelming tiredness that would take over sometimes took me to a neurologist. My husband and I were living out of state at the time, and the neurologist that I saw was not a movement disorder specialist, so he did lots and lots of tests and ultimately said he wanted to send me somewhere else. And I told my husband, please, can we just go back home to Rochester and you know, let them figure it out. So things fell into place, and we moved back here. And in between the move, Dr. Dorsey saw me and basically spent 40 minutes with me and said, I think you have Parkinson's.
You are a remarkable example of quality of life, I would think. You know, I mean, truly, 10 years on, I don't think I would have thought it's been 10 years since your diagnosis. I mean, what do I know at all? Nothing. But you really are pretty remarkable, hearing your story and seeing how physically fit you are and hearing that. So I just want to thank you for sharing it.
Thanks for letting me share. As I said earlier on, it's really important to me to give back and just let people know this isn't the end. I mean, there's plenty of time to get into things that you really want to do and make every minute count, and that's the gift that this has given me. Mm-hmm. You know, Dr. Dorsey said, go out and live your life. And
you're doing it. You're doing amazing things. And Dr. Dorsey, when you mentioned earlier that she might look like she's in better shape now than 10 years ago, mm-hmm. I would think that you'd want as many people as whoever come into your office with this diagnosis, they should see people like Jevon and think, not only is it not the end, but there's mm-hmm. really good times ahead, and that treatment and management is mm-hmm. has to be better than ever, right?
Absolutely. But I think the challenge is that we've heard great stories from Ms. Hilton and from Mrs. Smith's husband, but over 40% of people with Parkinson's disease don't see a neurologist, and those that don't mm-hmm. don't do as well as the individuals
yeah.
here.
Yeah.
And we're thinking there's a fundamental flaw in the way we provide care to individuals mm-hmm. with Parkinson's disease in general.
Mm-hmm.
We healthy clinicians ask sick patients to come see us on our terms, and instead we,
that's
the
right.
healthy yeah. clinicians, should be seeing the sick patients on their terms.
And that's, I was going to say that's a wrap. Does anybody say that anymore?
I guess you do.
And that's a wrap for another edition of Weekends, Weekends Connections. Week Connections. Do you want to read the rest of the script there? No?
Is there more?
No. There's not even a script there. That's Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm merely Evan Dawson, and I want to tell you that, when is the show? It's noon to two. That's Connections. Every weekday afternoon from...
You're rocking it this week.
That's so bad. We're keeping it. We're literally keeping this. I don't even care. Noon to two, WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM in the Finger Lakes, WEOS.
Good job. We're also on the WXXI mobile app. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll talk to you Monday.